Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Right, here we go. Let's fucking do some podcasting. Let's get the fuck out of here.
Let's do it.
Hello and welcome to this. It is the Egg Chasers Rugby Podcast, the podcast about rugby that doesn't take itself or the game too seriously, but we do take these scheduling issues very seriously, don't we, Phil?
Very, very, very seriously.
And as you might be able to tell, that is Phil, and I'm only with Phil today because Tim is missing in action.
Well, Tim is being incredibly professional and actually attending the games, I think, to give him his dues. He is single-handedly dragging that enormous Egg Chasers branded shipping container around the south of France from game to game to game.
Selflessly, not doing unspeakable things, not in pool parties with Swedish girls, not doing those things.
If I know Tim Cocker, he is absolutely not doing those things.
Why is it always turned into a Swedish pool party when Tim Cocker's involved? That's what I want to know.
Well, it doesn't.
If only it did. Right, so look, this is what we're going to do. We're going to talk about England because I want Tim's input on the rest of the weekend. So we've watched England, it's fresh in our mind, and we'll come back to maybe we'll talk a bit about Fiji, but we'll come back to the rest of the week's games tomorrow, maybe.
Well, there's been so much since we last podcasted. I feel like we did 100 podcasts in 4 days.
Yep.
And then it's been 100 days since we last podcasted. Because since we last podcasted, we had the epic battle that was France's second team versus Uruguay.
Oh God, we did, didn't we? And they did really well.
We did. That was a great game. That was legitimately a great game. And I love Uruguay. Absolutely love Uruguay. They're a handsome bunch of fellows, aren't they? Handsome bunch of powerful, dominant fellows.
They're not bad at rugby.
They're not bad at rugby. So we had that on Thursday night. We had New Zealand waltz and walk through Namibia on Friday night, which was a bit of a non-event, 71-3. We then had some interesting games on Saturday. Samoa, in the end, comfortably beat Chile, but it was interesting until half-time. Wales snuck past Portugal. Portugal, who, when they scored that try, that was a highlight of the weekend, actually, when Portugal scored that lovely little line-out move try against Wales. Ireland comfortably beat Tonga. South Africa today hammered Romania. Romania and Namibia are like the fall guys of this World
Cup. I agree with that. So, back in the day, everyone was rubbish except for the top teams.
Yeah, yeah.
Everybody was rubbish. I mean, yeah, they just were. And then, a few teams started getting good. Georgia, Japan. But I do genuinely think that the minor nations now, the emerging nations, that I don't know if World Rugby deserve the credit for it, or if the unions deserve the credit for it, or if the backers of the local clubs deserve credit. Someone deserves credit for something, because Portugal were mighty competitive. Uruguay have been a breath of fresh air, as have Chile. What more can you say? Japan played beautiful rugby today. They lost, but they did not look out of place against a Tier 1 nation at all.
There's a lot to take out of this. I'm still not quite sure how we paint. Maybe at the end of the tournament, we'll really understand how we can paint this Tier 2 upward curve narrative. But there is a lot to be positive about around those Tier 2 nations. And nothing more than tier one versus tier two, quarter to five today, Australia versus Fiji. Oh. And the tier two, the underdogs, although if anyone's been paying attention and anyone understands what Fiji, the arc that Fiji have been on, it's not really the underdogs, but the tier one versus tier two, Fiji,
well, Fiji challenges
Fiji
are
win.
Somewhat unique, aren't they, to, compared to the other nations? So, like Chile and, say, Uruguay are a self-sustaining nation of many millions of people. I think Fiji is like 1.5 million and it's not exactly a prosperous nation, to put it mildly. And it has no future probably being a prosperous nation. It's going to be Fiji for, you know, as long as it is. Because just demographics and geography and all the rest of it. Fiji's problem has always been twofold. A, all of its players leave. B, they still can't get home games. And let's put another one in there. Their players could never play together for an extended period of time. Well, now they can because of Fiji Drura. And that is a huge difference. A huge difference.
And it's a massive boost for the game. For Fiji to get their players, even if it's half of their players, even if it's 30, 40% of their players, together for a significant period of time, and then bolster it by having Naisa Levu and Joshua Tuasova and Semi Radrandra and Levani Bhatia and all of those stars come in from Europe to bolster what is already a good and cohesive Fiji Jura team.
Yes, exactly. Exactly.
It's ace. And it was like, I do like this Australia team. I've always had a soft spot for Eddie Jones. I've always liked what he's tried to do. And I really like the way that he has kind of ripped up the rule book and tried to restart things with Australia with maybe half a mind on everything in 4 years' time.
Yep.
Knowing he's got a free hit this time out because he came in so late. But with all that said, I still want Fiji to win. And I still love seeing a tier one nation, particularly Australia, being taken down by this amazing Fiji team. And it was a well-earned, totally, totally deserved win by Fiji.
Yeah. Now, it's anybody great to who see. Tells you in the morning something like, isn't that Fijian flair amazing? Tell them to shut up because they don't know what they're talking about. They didn't see this game. That was a masterclass in tactical awareness and strategic planning. It was really, really smart rugby that won that game.
Completely agree. Completely agree. And the same if you watched the Samoa-Chile game, which was a bit of an arm wrestle in the first half. Probably should have been 12-10 at halftime. But Samoa won that by their line-out and driving more.
Yeah,
no. That was why they won that game. It wasn't running in 50 metre tries and slinging it from wing to wing. It was by controlling the territory, controlling the game plan, and a great driving mall.
So, I don't want to blow my own horn, but I will, just this once. Just
on
hear
this
me
one
out.
Occasion.
Hear me out, Phil.
I have never heard you do this before,
no,
JB.
No,
so
no.
Please, on this one, make the most of it on this one occasion.
Yeah, I'll break my own rule. Let's not talk about myself too much. But I said it before, and I still think this is the thing. Tonga, Samoa, not Fiji, but Tonga and Samoa, the benefit they'll get from lads with high-level experience.
Mm.
I mean, they've always had precocious talent. They've always had guys that are exceptional rugby players.
And they've always had some enormous boys as
yes.
well. Like,
yeah,
it's,
yeah.
Not, it's not like they've lacked size previously.
Size, strength, all that stuff, yeah. They've got in abundance. They've got all the rare things. But what they didn't have was just that nous which you get from playing 100 caps of rugby or whatever it may be. I don't think anyone actually does have 100 caps who's coming to their team. But they do have boys that have been there and walked the walk on the biggest stage with some of the biggest teams. And then you just say, hey, calm down. Don't throw it coast to coast. Let's go for a line-out. Let's execute the line-out properly. Here's what works. Here's what doesn't work. This is what winning international test rugby is like. And that makes a difference. Makes a huge difference.
Well, Samoa, in that first half, when they tried to spread it wide and when they tried to play, Chile just said, okay,
yeah, like,
we can do this. Ayatsa and Rodrigo Fernandez, the 15 and the 10 yeah. for Chile, they love broken field play.
Yeah.
They absolutely eat up broken field play. What they don't like is kick for the corner, driving maul, with a pack that I think the Samoan pack was maybe 50 or 60 kilograms heavier than the Chilean pack.
Really?
Jesus Christ. Like, don't play it coast to coast when you've got that advantage. Just kick it in the corner and roll. And they scored three tries relatively early on in the second half by doing precisely that.
It does
that.
Show you a kind of, like a microcosm, I guess, if that's the right word for it, of how rugby has developed into the game it is. Because you have these great teams, like Chile. I think Chile are a great team.
They're a lovely team.
And they want to play rugby. So yeah. the skills there. So when anyone tells you, oh, rugby's a game of skills, to a degree. But as like Samoa showed, skills plus organisation. And that's why we get the tier one teams that we get today, because everybody's got skills. They're not rare. Everyone says they're rare. They're not rare. Okay? Organisation, cohesion is rare. You know, brute strength is rare. And then managing to kind of corral that and make sure it all functions as one, that's rare. And that's where rugby is now. So, you know, we've always had these talented teams, and now Samoa, hopefully Tonga will sort of follow, but who did they play last?
Well, they played Ireland this weekend.
Yeah, it didn't go well.
Which, I mean, I guess I made the point last week, which was, yes, Tonga have got some exceptional talent. They've got some enormous blokes. They've got some exceptional talent. But if one thing, based on when we saw them in Spain last year, if one thing they lacked, it is cohesion.
Yeah.
And they were coming up against just about the most cohesive team in world rugby.
Ireland are exactly.
And it showed.
Maybe not the pinnacle, but like the top 2.5 teams in the world.
Right? And they're the antidote to that. Like
that's exactly right.
The antidote to size and skill is the cohesion of Ireland.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. So, pretty cool to see the emerging nations. Tim Cocker doesn't like us calling them the tier twos. The emerging nations do so well. The Portuguese, just for a second here.
Right, we are bouncing around. I'll take it. Tim would have us like in this narrow
focus.
No, we'll
do what we want. We'll do what we want, because it makes a far more interesting conversation then.
Let's bounce around.
Yeah, let's bounce around. A far more interesting conversation than just... this is what people want to hear.
Well, I'm
tell them what they want to hear.
I'm 8 beers deep at this point, so I will bounce Perfect. Around all night.
That's what she said. So, let's crack on. Yeah, the Portuguese. Just let's talk about that red card, just for one second. I mean, what a world would be hoping to achieve here? What is anyone hoping to achieve with that?
So, right. We will see, because there'll be a disciplinary, there'll be a committee in either tomorrow or on Tuesday. The Ethan de Groot one has been called for Monday.
Of course, because Ethan de Groot got a red card.
Yeah, so on that one, I'm kind of hopeful that it does get called as just an accident. Even a yellow card is sufficient, therefore nothing more. This boy does not need to be banned anymore. Because I'm kind of for the old, if someone has done something wrong that people can learn from, let's try and shut that out. Whether that's a viable technique, whether it actually works or not, like I'm kind of for, let's try and stop that. This is not an issue that people can learn from.
Nope.
Like, people should not be jumping in to catch a ball with a leg extended out to kick someone in the face. That's not what happened here. A player, the Portuguese wing, if you've not seen it, the Portuguese winger jumps up in the air to try and catch the ball. He mistimes his jump, ends up leaning backwards, and his leading leg kicks out in front of him to try and stabilise himself, to stop him from falling on his back, from hurting himself. It catches Josh Adams in the face, probably hurts Josh Adams, but there's no real learning outcome for him or anyone else watching this, other than time your jump better, which everyone knows, and everyone is trying to time their jump better anyway.
It's as stupid as giving yellow cards. Here's how stupid it is. It's as stupid as giving yellow cards for a knock on. Nobody means to knock it on. It's exactly the same principle. Like, oh, well, just coach better. The people say that are thick. I mean, they're so stupid. We're at a stage now with rugby where The authorities need to realise that the game is not about them. It's about the players that play it and the people that watch it. And the people that are watching it, who have a view into rugby for the first time in a long time. A lot of people watching this World Cup have gone off rugby and they're returning to the game. And they're looking at this and thinking, what am I watching? Why is that even a penalty? Let alone these cards.
Well, I think this highlights a problem with the bunker, which
is... That's a problem with rugby, with world rugby. People that run it are not good at running sport.
But there's... So, with the bunker in particular, and this is a... maybe not quite everyone, but the majority of people, when you said, oh yeah, the bunker's going to be involved in the World Cup, with almost no preparation and no trial beforehand, most people are like, oh yeah, that's a good thing, because it means the referee... They can make their quick decisions, and then the decisions are taken off them, the game flows, it's all for the good of the game. But what people have forgotten, or didn't realise, and this is like law of unintended consequences, which, when you don't play something out before it actually happens, you don't get to see the unintended consequences.
Yeah.
We're seeing the unintended consequences live during a World Cup, which is not a good place to learn this.
Exactly. Any organiser of any big event will say you've got to have trial runs first. In fact, I'm pretty sure if you open a stadium, don't you need to do it like 10,000, 20,000, 30,000, 40,000?
You have to build up to like the equivalent of match day events.
Yeah.
Because you learn every time you do this. But we've not learned anything. We just jumped right in with a bunker. So we're seeing...
But it's not just the execution of the laws, is it? It's the mindset behind them. Well, it's people behind desks who are trying to regulate a high-collision, high-kinetic game. And they just don't understand it. From what I can tell, they do not understand it. And to make it worse, they then weaponize the opinions of people that do understand it with fake science. And it's just... Well, we can see... You know, don't tell me I don't know what I'm talking about. Me, personally, because that's what people say. When you're watching it on TV, and people who've watched the game their entire lives are watching it on TV, and going, what on earth is that?
Well, we've got... Particularly with the bunker, we've got at least a couple of problems. And I'm sure when I've had fewer beers, and I'm thinking more clearly, there will be more problems that come out from this. But there's at least a couple. So... Problem number one is the referees who are refereeing in the World Cup are at the pinnacle of their career.
Yeah.
Like, you've got a big hierarchy and a big process behind that to become the best referee in the world. Not the best TMO, not the best touch judge, but the best referee.
Yeah.
And behind them are the touch judges, and behind them are the fourth officials, and behind them are the TMOs. And so... By having the bunker, you are discharging the decisions from those people who are the best according to the hierarchy, whether they are definitively the best or not, but they're the best according to the hierarchy that's been set up.
Yeah.
And generally, that's probably a good thing. You're discharging those decisions from the best according to the hierarchy to not the best people.
By definition.
By absolute definition. And then you've got this second order problem, which is, and it's along those lines, but the referees, as soon as they see something that like superficially meets the red card threshold, they just discharge that decision. And what I mean is, like that Portuguese winger mistiming his jump, therefore kicking Josh Adams in the face, or a similar decision that was just before the World Cup, was the Peter Steph de Toit yellow card in the All Blacks South Africa game. Both of those, superficially, on the face of it, if you don't think too hard, they meet the yellow card threshold.
Yep.
But if you actually think hard about it, and you're a top-class referee, and I'm going to hate saying this phrase, because it's a phrase Tim loves, and I don't really like... because I think it cuts both ways and it's a bad phrase, but if you had a little bit of empathy for the person who committed the offence, and I know the risk of doing that...
Well, there's a lot of evidence that suggests showing empathy is not a good thing.
It's not a good thing. It's a phrase I dislike, but if you actually put yourself in the body of the offence committer, which generally I really, really dislike, but I think on both the Portuguese winger and the Peter Steph de Toit incident, it actually plays to my point. you can see that there is no learning outcome on both of those. Actually, not only should it not have been a red card, it also arguably shouldn't have been a yellow card. Both of those should have been rugby incidents and play on. But because the referee, the most qualified person in the incident, has not had to think too hard, because the thinking has been taken away to them and discharged to someone of a lower caliber than them, the decision gets made to upgrade. One got upgraded to a red card and one stayed as a yellow card, even though it actually shouldn't have even been a yellow card.
I mean, I'm not going to lie, I do find the conversation around the process of decision-making unbelievably boring.
But I love it. So, like, I'm happy to have those conversations.
So let me just pose this question to you. Then,
go on. Okay?
And then we must get off this because, I mean, we just must. But would you accept the argument then that the skill of a referee is the implementation of the game in real time around the nuts and bolts decisions like the ruck and the very dynamic, small but less consequential decisions which keep the game flowing, rather than the big decisions which are obvious and can be outsourced to a inferior official?
So once upon a time, I would have said, no, give me the right decision every time, regardless of how long that takes. I am totally on the other end of the spectrum now. I am totally, if you ask me now, given the way that the game has gone, I would say, make a referee decide everything, absolutely everything.
Yeah.
Apart from maybe like the last score emotion of a try, like the Johnny Williams try today, like where it's a knock on over the line.
Yeah.
The last half a second of real time, but other than that, decide absolutely everything in real time, right or wrong.
Mm-hmm.
But everyone knows it's right. Everyone knows it's going to be decided in real time.
Yeah.
Don't give me this halfway house of certain things are going to be decided in real time and they're never looked upon again.
And I'll tell you why this
And certain things are gone through. Like, 60% of the stuff is decided in real time and 40% of the stuff is gone through in minute frame-by-frame detail. That is a not... It's yeah, just it is.
Because if you... But, so, if you have only a referee in charge, as in your... example, what you tend to have, like in the olden days, are certain laws which will be prioritised by the ref because he can't see everything. So you'll have a situation where there'll be multiple infringements, but as long as the law that the ref isn't looking for is not infringed, then play on. There's a very famous clip, isn't there, of Wales, South Africa, penalties, who knows which way, after five or six infringements, but the referee's
everyone's
just
diving off their feet on a rook.
The referee is looking at something else, right?
Yeah.
So your point, to come to your point, you do have that situation, don't you, where the referee is only looking to enforce the things he wants outside of a scope of politically important things which World Rugby want enforcing, and they go to the bunker. And it's just basically the expression of World Rugby politics by rugby laws. That's all it is. Some things don't matter, some things do.
Well, I'll tell you one really refreshing thing that I thought I would have hated, but I actually loved, was in the... It was definitely the first game, maybe the first and second game. They didn't really show replays of tries. Certainly not replays of tries that could have contradicted this try being scored.
Yeah.
And the great example was the, I think it was the second Talaya try in the France New Zealand game, which was a clear forward pass. And they never showed a replay of it.
No, they did not, did they?
Which was astonishing, given that it was a French television crew.
I can't believe it.
But like, if that is the standard that we're going to set, that we are not really going to scrutinise things that... in the heat of the moment, they looked amazing. Therefore, we're not really going to scrutinise it, because it looks amazing to the cameras. And a point that you made this point years and years ago, but I think it's not the worst standard to hold us to. If there was a 12-year-old boy on the sideline and he's excited, do we go back and disappoint that 12-year-old boy? Maybe not. If that is going to be the standard, it's consistently held. I'm okay. I never thought I'd say this. I'm actually okay with that.
Yeah.
I'm fine with that. The problem we've got
put 12-year-old boys in the bunker. link them up to heart monitors.
Yeah, yeah.
Laughometers, you know. Make sure that they're engaged. If they're enjoying it, just play on, boys.
Yeah.
Now, there's no point in saying we're going to engage kids by giving them, I don't know, balls with graffiti writing and adding extra Zs to the word hits or, you know, whatever the RFU are trying this week. Just show them men colliding with other men. See if they enjoy it. I bet they do.
But what we've got is this position where occasionally we'll get that, namely that, I think it was the second Talia try. But time after time again, and this weekend has been just as bad as any other that I can remember, where a player scores, notably that Johnny Williams try as an example, and there's dozens of others. Johnny Williams scores a try, everyone celebrates, but just as the kicker, just as Anscombe or whoever it was, is lining up the kick, Halfpenny in that instance, is lining up the kick, we get called back because someone has not spotted a knock-on over the line that happened within a fraction of a second. And like, yes, it was the right outcome, but how much is lost? And like, I've spoken to friends this weekend who watch football and hate the way that VAR's gone with football, but see, rugby is an even worse example where you never know until the subsequent kickoff from a try. You don't know whether the points are actually going to be awarded and you can actually relax and breathe a sigh of relief because the team you want to score has actually scored, and that is not a good position to be in.
No, I completely agree with all of that. Now, I will just add something else to the red card debate before we go, which is I think you're going to end up with a situation when you play your first team only for big games, because everyone's worried about the injury risk, but I actually think the red card risk is now more substantial than the injury risk, and this just should not be a reason not to pick your best players. You know, Ethan de Groot is out of the World Cup, for example. I mean, he's not out of the World Cup, but he could miss some important games, and that results in him being out of the World Cup. You know, Owen Farrell is not eligible to play at the moment. Tom Curry is not eligible to play at the moment. Billy Vunipola's just come back. The list goes on. Does it go on? It might not go on. But, you know,
Might be it.
That might be it. But these are big names. You know, it's not a joke. It's not a joke. People pay a lot of money to come and see the best players play, and to have so many of them banned for offences that people can't actually work out why seems ridiculous. Like, when you're nearly at one-third of an international team, you're going to have to really, really consider your point. Because I get holding your players back for injury, but to make decisions based on potential red cards, because I'm sure the red card risk is higher than the injury risk at the moment.
It's probably not far off.
Yeah, so you know, it's just the whole thing's an absolute nonsense.
I personally don't mind the red cards. Like, I'm okay with yellow and red cards. I don't, to take your point from previously, I don't even necessarily think it's going to change behaviours, but I'm okay with the principle on the principle of, well, we must get, like, people need to tackle lower or we need to change behaviours. I'm okay with using that as a tool. Where my problem is...
Change behaviour is the word of a moron. Well, anyone who says that phrase to me instantly has the IQ of, like, an Alsatian.
Well,
instantly. A whole phrase is... Fucking morons.
Let's just say, rather than change behaviours, let's just say...
They're fucking morons.
Let's just say idiots. Let's just say incentivise. Let's say incentivise players to do something different.
Yeah.
Whether it does or not. But where I struggle is, let's say there was two tackles on Thursday and Friday.
Let's not take any more tackles and move on.
Are you...
Yeah, not to be Tim Cock about this. Let's move on. Well, because I do not want to talk about any more disciplinary nonsense.
Well, you've got the Taufi Fanua on... Thursday night.
Okay, and by all means, continue.
Ethan de Groot. And I'm not going to labour this point. Those two, for me, are broadly the same tackles. One gets given a yellow card, one gets given a red card. I can't quite see. And this is the same point as Tom Curry, the Chilean player on the Japanese player, the Jesse Creel on Jack Dempsey, the multiple tackles in the Fiji-Wales game. Like, if you are, and I'm, the point I made before was, if you're going to go to this microcosm of ultra detail, you have to get it right. I'm not actually that bothered about that. Uh-huh. Like now, I thought I would be that bothered.
Yep.
But now, if it's going to be an on-field decision with a ref where things are made incorrectly, I'm okay with that. But you've got to make everything have the 50-50 chance of being incorrect. You can't do what we're doing, which is certain things get under the magnifying glass mm-hmm. and get called right or wrong and scrutinised to the nth degree and given red cards. Mm-hmm. But the same offences
yep.
that are almost identical are not looked at.
So, Phil, if I was Tim now, I would say, that's a really interesting point, Tim, Phil. And if I wanted to move on, he would say, well, it's an interesting debate. You've got some great thoughts. I'm sure that debate will rumble on. So I'm sure it will rumble on.
I'm sure it will.
Now,
I'm going to get off my high horse now.
Perfect.
Thank you, Tim, for correcting me.
Yeah, for interjecting there. Yeah. Now, we could talk about the games today. We could talk about the results and the scores and who did what. But actually, I want to talk about a slightly different tangent. Not really related to the games, but what did we learn from one of the games in particular? And that would be South Africa versus Romania. Well, no one thought we'd be talking about this one because it was an absolute washout.
Well,
but here's what I want to talk about.
Yeah, so let's just set this up. Last week, Ireland beat Romania by 70 points.
Yeah.
This week, South Africa beat Romania by 70 points. What can we learn?
Well, I'm glad you asked. It is the potential genius of the South African squad selection.
The four scrum halves.
The four scrum halves that Malcolm Marx sadly has departed the World Cup, which is a massive blow for everyone who loves rugby.
Yeah, yeah. Malcolm Marx is one of the premier
players on the planet.
He's one of the three best hookers on the planet, and he is more than a hooker because he can do absolutely everything.
So what I love about the South Africa team is they just don't really care very much. It's like it's like they don't know anything about rugby and they've been given all these players and they're just picking based on what they think rather than perceived wisdom. So if you know your stuff, sometimes you say, maybe you don't take four scrum halves, maybe you need more than one fly half. But I love the fact
maybe you don't have four scrum halves in your 23.
Yes, maybe you don't do that. But they seem just to be picking the players that work for them based on what they want to do. And I absolutely love it. I absolutely love it.
I love it as well. Maybe you don't play seven forwards on the bench. Or maybe you do and you smash the All Blacks.
Exactly. You know, it's gone from 6-1, 6-2 to 7-1.
Yeah.
Because it works for them.
And back to a 5-3, of which two of the bench this week were scrum halves. To complement two of the starting 15.
I wonder if some of the other Tier 1 nations are going to step back and look at South Africa and think, maybe we should just pick our best players. I know this sounds ridiculous.
No.
Why don't we just pick the most talented players that we have?
You are nuts. You're absolutely crazy.
And you know, something which I've been talking about for a long time is positional flexibility. Like, this is a big thing at lower level rugby. So I kind of get why you might think that the game evolves differently at the high level, where you become a specialist and you're so good and those extra 2% of what you do really matters. But I guess outside of the set piece, you're just playing rugby. So today we saw the interesting spectacle of the two sevens, well, a guy wearing six and a guy wearing seven, both playing hooker in place of Benombo. Say his name again?
Benombi Umbenombi.
Yeah, him. Right? Dean Ferry and the guy who used to be at Leicester but is no longer at Leicester.
Van Staden.
Marco Van Staden.
Yeah.
They were both throwing in. Marco Van Staden definitely scrimmaged at hooker. This is really valuable. It's valuable for a few reasons. It shows everybody in the world that plays rugby that you don't need to be a front row necessarily to play front row.
Mm-hmm.
It's not to say that these guys haven't worked on it or they're no good. It just means that, look, positional flexibility is possible. It's a great message to be sending to low-level rugby.
To lower level, it's
an amazing message.
It's a huge message because the number of games that have been put in jeopardy or even called off because a team can't field a front row.
Yeah.
And this is a point that you've made for years and years and years and years. You just need to push. You just need to bend over and push. Like, you don't need to be some superhero. Just bend over and push.
Yeah, Marco Van Staden, in another world, could be a hooker. Look at him. Dion Ferry could be a hooker. Like, there's nothing intrinsically back rowy about them. Like, they just happen to play there.
Look at, I imagine, and this is a point you've made, the weight regime that, for example, say, Billy Vunipola versus Mako Vunapola. The weight regime that the two of those boys have been on over the last 15 years as professional rugby players, and delete Billy Vunapola and put any international back row. Put Carl Ferns in there. Put Jasper Visa in there. Put anyone in there. And the weight regime, the training regime is basically the same.
Yeah, it is.
There is some skill to it, but it's not the differential that people have held it to be.
No. So that's really good. Seeing Grant Williams on the wing, he's just magnificent.
He's so fast.
They can move Caden Moody about. They've only got one fly half. Oh, except for Wilhelmser, who can play everywhere because he's amazing. It's just common sense, isn't it? Play your best players. Now, there is a little bit of that, I guess, with the All Blacks, who move the Bowden Barrett about a bit. Nothing to this extent.
D-Mac. And, they're starting centres for the All Blacks, Jordy Barrett and Rico Ioane.
Mm.
They have and do swap around. They can play right across the back line. So there is... They're not alone... but certainly in the Northern Hemisphere.
Just makes you think, though, doesn't it? Like, what opportunities is rugby missing as a sport? So, if you've got the ability to switch out a traditional front row with something a little bit more dynamic because you're winning the scrum, well, why not? Like,
we might have an enormous fish on the end of our fishing line, JB.
Then, we'll just have a look, see if Tim has joined us.
An enormous, elegant...
He'll be amazed and horrified we've not spoken about England yet. The only thing that's important is England.
We've been saving it for him. Enormous, elegant
headphones
fish.
Headphones on, mate. Headphones on, or you're not going
to be able to hear him. Got him. I'm one step ahead.
Tim Cocker.
Tim Cocker. Hello.
I don't know if you're going to be horrified or if you're going to be happy that we've not spoken about England yet in a 40-minute podcast. So, we've done the Romanians in detail. We've done, what else have we done?
We've done...
Portuguese.
We've done Ireland, Fiji, Australia, Romania, Namibia, Uruguay, Chile, and we were saving England for your arrival, Tim Cocker.
Now, Tim, just before you interject, I'll finish off my story. So, Bowden, right?
Bowden Barrett.
No, come on.
We're just going to do Bowden Altrincham and then you're up, yeah? Do you know what? We'll talk about Bowden right
afterwards.
Yeah.
When Tim dials that. So, Tim.
How are you, Tim?
Tim, were you at the game?
I'm at the stadium right now. I'm looking at the groundsman forking the pitch.
Well, how was it? I guess you were there on the ground. What was it like?
The England fans tried their very best to muster some atmosphere.
Uh-huh.
They did. They were very committed to that. The Japanese fans were great, but I think underwhelmed is how I feel. And I'm disappointed more after last week that there wasn't another step taken forward. But then I also, with how low my expectations were, it's the same as Wales. I'm almost kind of thinking, which is what I said yesterday about Wales. Well, they got 5 points. That's something.
Yes, I think that's probably a good way to look at it because you did get that fourth try and that was important.
Yeah. The four tries and a win and keep stepping forward. And I'm kind of of the opinion that you don't need to play too much flair rugby in order to progress in a World Cup. You need to win the knockout games.
Yeah.
And England played a limited game plan that will probably suit knockout rugby.
Well, I'm not
going to... There were two very distinct opinions. I've just been out chatting with some fans, and there were two very distinct opinions. There was one opinion much like yours, Phil, which is, it's a win, and I'd take winning the World Cup really ugly. So, you know, let's just be happy with a win and take it and move on and try and build. The other opinion was, I don't believe we're going to win the World Cup. And so I'd rather lose going out swinging.
Yeah, so... For the record, I don't think we're going to win the World Cup. But I think we've got a better chance of progressing doing what we're doing than going out swinging. So yeah. I'm for that reason, I'm okay with it.
Yeah, I'd say Well, England today made Japan look like a very good team. Until the very end, Japan looked like a very, very good team. Their scrum was solid. Their line-out work was pretty good, except for when Courtney interjected at times. But
big courts.
Hey, it's Danny Pellegrino from Everything Iconic. Ready to upgrade your style game without blowing your budget? Check out Quince. They've got all the good stuff, shirts and polos, activewear and fine leather goods, all at 50 to 80% less than other high-end brands. And the best part? They're all about safe, ethical and responsible manufacturing. Get that luxury vibe without the luxury price tag. Hit up quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns on your next order. That's quince.com/upgrade.
Quality sleep is essential. That's why the Sleep Number Smart Bed is designed for your ever-evolving sleep needs. Need a bed that's firmer or softer on either side? Helps you sleep at a comfortable temperature? Sleep Number Smart Beds let you individualize your comfort, so you sleep better together. J.D. Power ranks Sleep Number number one in customer satisfaction with mattresses purchased in-store. And now, save 40% on the Sleep Number Limited Edition smart bed for a limited time. For J.D. Power 2023 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards. Only at Sleep Number stores or sleepnumber.com.
Most part was good. And I think that their open field running, their attacking play in open field, the way they can create fast ball is night and day different to England, who seem to just struggle to get the momentum. That's a big takeaway from me. They
on the flip side,
there's
clearly some work's been going on the training ground. That Joe Marler headbutt move is inspired.
You never saw that coming.
Loved it. Absolutely loved it. Well, the quick ball, JB, is a great point. And I just think it's a... England are not trying... When you watch Ireland, when they're going for it, they are trying to create... They're actively trying to create quick ball. England are actively trying to slow down the ball. It's just... I'm sure they could do it if they wanted to. They just have no interest in doing it.
Do you know what? There was a perfect example of that. So, again, this is one of the aspects that I get to see from... So I was literally in the back row of the whole stadium, and there was one moment where a massive groan from the crowd went in when Alex Mitchell, just inside the Japanese half, kicked a ball, and it just trickled down to the Japanese player, who then cleared it back. And the crowd moaned at Alex Mitchell. On the face of it, you sort of go, oh, well, that was a real... Well, what'd you do that for? However, the perspective I had was I looked right across the pitch, and all of the England players who were having to jog to get back on side behind where Alex Mitchell was were doing exactly that. They were jogging. They were ambling. There was no urgency to get in a position to cause any kind of attacking threat, almost as if, oh, well, it's going to be a kick, so I don't really need to.
Yeah.
That's exactly what we mean.
They at least understand the game plan that's going to be played, which is a limited game plan.
I mean, I don't know this for a fact, but when I watch Ireland, like Phil says, they seem to have a process that they go through as to how they generate the next ruck and then the next play, and it gets gradually quicker and quicker and quicker. England just do not have that there. They don't practice for it. They don't train for it.
They don't want to. They actively don't want... They occasionally, on turnover ball, they'll play quite wide. And then at that moment, that specific moment in time, they'll want quite a quick ruck. Other than that, they do not want it. They want rook in order to get good position to box kick the ball, in order to get a kick chase, in order to put pressure on the opposition. That is it. And it's that limited game plan, which is fine. Which, once you know it, if you're expecting a team to play wide, you're going to be disappointed.
Yeah.
But once you know it, it means that you should at least have an arm wrestle to be in the game with 20 minutes to go.
Yeah, I mean, go on, Tim.
No, I wasn't going to say anything. I'm just listening. It's fine. You carry on.
Oh, sorry. Your line was sort of bubbling along in the background there. The problem is they're not even very good at the game plan. I mean, that's what really bothers me.
They were very good last week at the game plan, at playing that precisely limited game plan, putting pressure on the opposition, getting territory. This week, they were adequate. They were good enough. They scored 4 tries. They conceded 0 tries. They can see 12 points, all of which were kicks, which I think they'll be very happy with. Like, this is not a game plan to make rugby kind of newbies swoon over their coast-to-coast game. This is a game plan to try and give themselves a shot of being competitive and within the game with 20 minutes to go. And they've done that successfully the last 2 weeks.
Here's a question for you. Why do we not see Theo Dan earlier in the game?
Great question. Why did we not see him earlier in the pre-season games or the pre-tournament warm-up games?
Because if something happens to Jamie George...
Well, all of England's eggs are in a literal Jamie George-shaped basket.
Yeah.
And if that basket gets cracked or crushed for some reason...
Or red-carded...
That's all we needed tonight. We needed someone to take one for the team and take it, get a red card, and we would have been all right.
It would have been
50 points.
Big win. Well, so, other than the red card, this is an interesting point of England the last 2 weeks. Other than the Tom Curry red card, and Tom Curry, heinous crime, Steve Diamond has taught him everything he knows. He's a wrong un. We all know that. But other than that, England conceded 7 penalties last week. And six penalties this week.
That's remarkably low.
It's remarkably low. It really is. Like, England, for the past few years, have been double digits in a half digits. Like, so for 7 and 6 across 160 minutes, that is remarkably low. And if they keep that up, if they keep the discipline up, combined with that limited kicking, kick chase, try and eat territory, try and put pressure on the opposition's kick receipt and ruck clearance. I am not saying England are going to win a World Cup, but it's not a bad strategy when you've got a new team, when you're playing a limited game plan.
Well, there are some things that you look out for, I think. And if I'm not going to go down the controversial statement of saying there may be green shoots, right? But that is a great basis to start from. If you can be disciplined, you can also afford to be quite bad and hope that it picks up. Discipline in rugby is so, so important.
Or just be bad in the opposition's 22 or near the opposition's 22. You can be as bad as you want. You've got to be really bad to concede a try from the opposition's 22.
And sometimes they are that bad, in fact.
Yeah.
But they are disciplined.
England have shown multiple times they can be that bad.
Yeah.
But hopefully they get their act together this time.
Because they look like a worse, less cohesive unit than Japan for the most part of this game.
Yeah. But they've done okay.
Yeah, agreed.
I'm just moving out of someone's way. I keep coming back to the 5 points. I just think that, so there's something else at play here which I can't get out of my head, which is I don't believe we're going to win the World Cup. And I know I love rugby, and I know rugby's in a really bad way. And therefore, I almost feel like there is a duty. And again, this is the question. What is the duty of a rugby team and a coach? Steve Borthwick's only job is to win rugby matches.
Yep.
And they hired him knowing exactly what he would do. And he probably told them what he would do. And he's doing exactly what we expected. So I'm not surprised. But here we are at a Rugby World Cup. And I know that my family, my kids and wife, sat down to watch that game. They got a takeout and thought they'd sit down. And that never happens in our house. It's always just me, maybe me and my son. And I haven't spoken to them, but I cannot imagine there will be much appetite to do that again. And I know that isn't Steve Borthwick's job, but
Japan are exciting.
England can win a World Cup. I think I can't help thinking there's an element of responsibility to be a custodian of the game in that sense. And that doesn't fit with professional sport and individual philosophies. But what do you think of that?
I think that you make a valid point about the entertainment value of rugby. But I always come back to this. It's like the box kick, right? So the box kick has to go because it's a heinous crime, as does a caterpillar. But the best people to make make entertaining rugby, believe it or not, is rugby players and coaches. So if you just leave the rules as it is, they will eventually figure out a way to score points and a way to make it exciting. The example I always give is the box kick is awful. Yeah, it's awful, and then someone worked out how to defend it, and then they do this little thing where they throw it to the 10, and then he kicks to the other side, and that's exciting. So just let the game evolve naturally. And I think what you're saying is partly a product of Steve Borthwick wanting to win, but also partly a product of the continual tinkering of the laws and, you know, coaches trying to go for the safest option, you know, sort of base level rugby. Just leave them up, leave them to it, and eventually they will do something. And one thing Phil said is, if you expect it, there are all sorts of ways to play different sorts of sports. And if you just acknowledge that the team that you're watching are based around great defence, great discipline, and a bit of brutality, you can start to celebrate that eventually. But it's that team identity that needs to be discovered and then celebrated.
Yeah, and no one here would say France and New Zealand are boring teams, but England kicked 42 times today.
Uh-huh.
I think in the France-New Zealand, the opening game, I think New Zealand kicked 39 times and France kicked 44. So yeah, basically the same number of times. And so it's not just that England are a boring team. It's there's an element of gamesmanship about this. And there's an element of making the basics, the boring, interesting.
Yeah.
Like,
yes.
If the kick chase is seen as an opportunity to put pressure on the opposition and therefore win penalties and therefore win scoring opportunities, it's very different to, just another kick.
Contestable kicks are super exciting.
Yeah. This is a way to win rugby matches, and that is the primary thing. Like, that is what Steve Borthwick is employed to do, and this is the best he can do with the team that he's got.
And do you know what? There are some boring elements of England, but they're boring because they're rubbish. There are guys in that team who actually are exciting. I was watching Alex Mitchell today. Yes, he kicked that ball away, but when he's actually trying to move the ball, you can see the endeavour in that lad. And that's exciting. Ben Earl is another one. Lewis Ludlam is another one.
Lovely. Yeah.
Yeah, there are lads who are actually trying to make things happen. I suspect, and I hate saying this because I've said England are rubbish a lot of times, I think they're going to turn a corner. I've just got this sneaky feeling they're about to turn a corner based on their discipline and lads like Alex Mitchell.
Well, I think, and we've said this so many times, I think England, unless something goes catastrophically wrong, they'll top their group.
Yeah,
they will then play either Australia or Fiji or Wales or possibly Georgia, depending on how that group goes.
Yeah,
and they should win that. Like playing that limited game plan, they'll be 60-40 favourites to win against whoever they play. But then they play either France or New Zealand or South Africa or Ireland or Scotland, one of those five teams. They're going to play, and they're going to get punched in the face, and they're going to lose. And that's where it all comes down. Perhaps. They should get to a World Cup semi-final, and who knows what happens.
I just think, you know, the England line-out is going to get a lot tighter. So when they're playing their territory game and they're forcing line-outs, that is going to be the big difference. When they finally nail that line-out, like properly nail it, that's going to be a hell of a weapon for them.
But that line-out should be...
I don't mean to maul it. I mean for launch plays.
Yeah, but they're not trying to launch plays. They're not trying to launch backline moves. And this line-out has seen... I mean, how many thousands of times has Jamie George thrown to Mario Toji?
Yeah, why is it not happening now?
They've played 200 games together in club and country. They must have had 20 line-outs a game.
Yeah, fair.
That could be 2,000, 4,000 line-outs.
But if they get to the Leicester Tigers style of line-out when they win the league... It's going to be lethal. It will be lethal.
Yeah, but there was one moment which I think kind of summarised it. And again, the caveat here is that they got the 5 points, they scored 4 tries, and they did open up a little bit in towards the end. But there was one moment in the first half where England had really good ball, quick ball. I think it might have even been a launch play from a line out. Manu Tuilagi ran straight into a defender and the ball was passed behind him. But you kind of... I don't know what you're... like. I don't know. I don't quite have the. I sort of don't think there's a major problem with the line out. I don't think the line out is an issue. It's like how it doesn't matter how good the ball is. It's the fact they can't do anything with it.
Yeah.
Yeah. So they actually choose not to do anything with it.
Well, when I talk about the line out, I don't mean the actual physical sort of bringing it down and mauling it. I mean using line outs as a launch play, which is exactly what Tigers were brilliant at. So it's a little bit more expanded than just saying line up ball at school. Yeah. But yeah, that's what they're not good at, actually. They run sideways.
I'll come back to it again. I just Baz is going to be playing 12 in this team, and it will be better than what they're capable of doing right now with Manu at 12 or Ollie Lawrence at 12 for that matter.
Ollie Lawrence I'd go with at 12 over Faz and Manu. I just don't think they're good options for 12.
It's clearly like all game plan stuff, because what would Joe Marchant do if he had even a sniff at a 2-on-1 in the 15-metre channel?
He would
third of the way with 1/3 of the pitch left in front of him, and he had a Queen's jersey on.
He'd form a ruck and wait for Danny Kerr to box kick it.
Hit deck just before contact.
Yeah, that's what he would do.
I've never seen Joe Marchant in that position with it. Like, it might have been 2-on-2, but it was almost a 2-on-1. He could have potentially created a 2-on-1, and he was just outside the Japanese 22, and he nudged it through. He did a grubber kick straight into touch.
Tactics.
Yeah, exactly. That's what I mean. It's tactic, because that's Joe Marchant doing that. And I just kind of don't see the point of having him out on the field. If you want to play like that, put Faz on the field.
So one question I've got for you, Tim. How hot was it in the stadium? Because both sets of players just could not keep hold of the ball, it seemed like. There were so many basic not problems from both sides.
Lots of basic errors. Now, it's I wouldn't say it's excessively hot at all. It's, you know, it's probably about 20 degrees right now, something like that. That's just a guess. It would have been a little warmer during the game, but not hot by any stretch.
Yeah, and it shouldn't be that bad.
No, and I did hear Steve Borthwick in the press conference, which was going out on the TV in the media room. I did hear him talking about they dealt with the conditions and. So I don't know if there's anything in it that I'm not aware of. Maybe there is a level of humidity that's affecting the ball. But, I mean, it won't be any worse than Japan.
No,
well...
It would be significantly better than Japan, I would suggest.
Yeah, well, both teams are playing in it. And, yeah, I'm absolutely certain, from us being in Japan, where it was mid-30s and 90% humidity, it is not that hot in France.
Nothing like that.
Yeah,
nothing like that.
Now, before we do talk about a team that are different tactically to... how we expect. Can I just draw our attention to the absolutely ludicrous Land Rover adverts which have polluted the World Cup?
The Defender adverts.
The Defender. Why is it that this Defender has to basically haul a homosexual lump of metal around France? Like, what is the point of this? So, they've made a statue of a gay man, all very well. A gay man that, from what I can tell, has never actually...
Hold on.
No,
I was going to say, because I haven't seen this, because I've been blissfully unaware, just like I wish 4 years ago I was with you guys in Japan and I didn't have to listen to Paloma Faith. Oh, yes. That was 2015, wasn't it, Paloma Faith?
Well, it was.
The version of World in Union. That's the worst.
So Land Rover...
That is the worst.
Do one that was massive...
No. What was it? The question I was going to ask was, how can you... I don't understand how you can make a statue of a gay man, because, like... What is the characteristic that means you can look at a statue and go, that's a gay man?
I have no idea, but this gay man in France is very important. He set up the first gay team, and therefore you have to make a statue of him.
Oh, I see. So it's explained that he is. That's what I was confused.
They've not carved him.
Are they going with like real stereotypes here or something?
No. They've not carved him to like Freddie Mercury holding a rugby ball. Like that isn't what's going on. Although that would be quite good. It'd be instantly recognisable as what it is. No, this is just a normal man in rugby gear who is gay. They've carved him into a statue, and they drag the homosexual statue around France on the back of a Land Rover, because apparently this is essential. This is why you buy a Discovery. However,
Defender.
However, there's a second version of this advert, and this version of the advert is a kid with no left forearm.
Oh, I've not seen this.
Yeah. So the other one is this poor kid, no left forearm. So it's a gay man. Do they equate being gay with not having an arm? Is it like a disability to Land Rover? Is this what they're trying to tell us? Like, you're very important. In fact, you're so important and special. We think being gay is the same as being disabled. Here's a statue. Let's drag it around with our Defender.
So, what did this man do something significant? Was he, was he a pioneer in some way? Did he break down a...
Oh, they're all pioneers, Tim. They're all pioneers.
No, but I bet you he probably did. Did he do something significant to...
Except the first gay team in France.
Yeah. So according to the text,
okay,
he said right. that, so the equivalent of the King's Cross Steelers like or the Manchester Spartans.
By the way, a wonderful achievement.
It is a great thing to do.
For the Bingham Cup. But, you know, if Land Rover do, if Land Rover are serious about their equality goals, why don't they go and put the same amount of money into the Bingham Cup? It, or
maybe
the, is
maybe
it
they
nothing
do?
To do with equality and everything to do with more and everything to do with cynical marketing,
selling £100,000 defenders?
Yeah, it is about selling because if they were if serious about equality, take that money, go and sponsor the Bingham Cup. That would be wonderful.
Great thing to do.
Now, from what I can tell, neither the kid with the missing arm or the gay man have played a single second of World Cup rugby. They have not contributed one second of memories to World Cup rugby, except for being immortalised in statues to be dragged around by £100,000 defenders.
Enormous, solid lumps of steel.
Yeah, but such an amazing message for everyone at home to see. Ram down your throat continuously.
What did I get angry about the other day? On Friday night, Thursday night, not even Friday night. I couldn't even save my anger until the Friday. On Thursday night, I got a little bit angry because the Taufi Finua bunker yellow card that stayed as a yellow card.
Yeah.
When it was discussed, I didn't actually listen to the halftime comms, but when it was discussed post-match, Maggie Alfonsi and friend of the podcast, Gareth Thomas,
icon and role model Gareth Thomas.
Friend of the podcast, icon and role model Gareth Thomas, were discussing it afterwards, and at no point did either of them, like, they both kind of like nodded along and like agreed with the fact that it should have been a yellow card. At neither point did either of them ever entertain the fact that whether you think it's right or wrong, World Rugby's own laws and own directive on the high tackle head contact framework states that an always illegal tackle can never be mitigated down. When the Taufi Finua was always a tucked arm that never attempted a wrap, therefore never could have been mitigated down, and yet they both made the example that it should and it was right to have been mitigated down.
Do you know?
Which is it's this lazy nodding through whatever.
Carrying water. Yeah. It does feel a bit like that.
So, one of the things that they did, right? I know exactly what you're talking about, Phil, because one of the things that they did was they came out at half time with, do you know what? I'm going to defend. Was it Matt Carley in charge?
Matt Carley was stepped down this week, wasn't he? He did last weekend.
Was it Paul Williams?
Was it Paul Williams or was it Ben O'Keefe?
It was Ben O'Keefe. I'm going to defend Ben O'Keefe. Now, to be honest, when they said that jarred with me because I thought he's had a good game. Like, it's not having a bad game.
So I thought Ben O'Keefe overall, but this was my point before about the bunker, which is he just discharged that decision to someone who is less qualified than him.
Yeah.
Because as soon as he deems it meets the yellow card threshold,
off it goes.
He then does not consider the mitigating factors. Yeah. And that's, you are stepping down something for someone who has met the hierarchical threshold to someone who has not met the hierarchical threshold.
Yes,
it's a nonsense.
Just on this one, okay, so do you know how you know a commentary team is not very good? Like, this is a legitimate thing.
There's a few reasons, but go on.
But this is one of them, right? They were saying Ben O'Keefe has done a marvellous job of explaining his decision there. And they just parrot the decision of the ref. Now, a good commentary team would say, like, Austin Healey would have no truck with that.
He'd challenge it.
He'd go, well, that's the wrong decision. It doesn't matter that he's explained it. It doesn't matter that he's explained the wrong decision. It's the wrong decision.
Or he would actually say, yes, he's come to the right decision, but he's explained it in the wrong manner.
Yes.
Like, he's somehow got the wrong words in the right order to end up at the right decision.
Yeah, Austin Healey would absolutely nail that left, right, and centre. When you've got a bad comms team, all they do is they just repeat stuff which they've heard before. So if the ref is saying, yeah, he didn't roll away, he explained it nice and clearly, but he did roll away, or he did rejoin the ruck, or he did rejoin the mall, or whatever the thing is that you see as a commentator, you should be challenging that. Don't just parrot the referee.
It's not the commentator's job to do that, but I know what you mean, the people in the commentary team.
The analyst. Yeah. The analyst is what I meant.
Yeah.
And the other thing the analyst did the other day was, I think it was since of... I can't remember which game it was, but someone had just scored the supposed better team. I said, well, they'll just open up here and then, you know, it will all be over. And it didn't happen. It was just lazy commentary. Like, we do need better analysts. Much, much better analysts. People have done this before on a regular basis, because some of the guys that they're wheeling out are dreadful. They're legitimately dreadful. Last thing on Gareth Thomas.
Yes, please.
I'm going to take a completely different tone towards Gareth Thomas from now on. I've been disgusted about his involvement. But now I'm going to be incredibly pro-Gareth Thomas and use him as an actual role model. Look what can be achieved with, like, just barefaced dishonesty. He should be a hero to all villains. I actually want him to be on everything now. if I take the counter... So the only reason he exists, right, is because he is basically counter to all the things that I believe. But if I recruit him onto my team in order to demonstrate what can be possible if you just lie and do all the wrong things in life, I think that's the way that we should go. More Gareth Thomas on everything, please.
But he's not...
He's a role model to me as to how to get away with everything.
He's not even... If he was... Like an Austin Healey, like, sees things differently and can give a different perspective onto...
What do you mean? He's a gay man. It's the only perspective he needs.
He is like objectively a bad pundit.
Absolutely.
And then hey, you have if all you want, this extra baggage.
If you want a man who can look at a situation and tell you how to get away with absolutely anything in that situation, Gareth Thomas is the man that you want. Right? He's the perfect antidote to boring TV. How to get away with everything. That's the man.
Can I make a point on the bunker system and the cards and stuff that seems to be coming to light as far as I can see?
Please, yes.
Which is maybe restricting the ability of the analyst to call a spade when it's right to do so. And I do agree with you, Phil, on the strength of the footage that was shown. The Roman Tau for Finua, if I were an analyst, I'd be saying that is not following the framework that is there to govern these incidents.
Yes.
But this also happened with the Jesse Creel situation with South Africa. Now, I haven't seen this supposed other footage, which clearly shows, apparently, and I'll take it at face value from many people that have said this, apparently there's another angle which shows that the first contact from Jesse Creel was on the ball, not on the shoulder or neck or head. Much like I would point out Owen Farrell's tackle on Andre Esterhazy back in 2018, by the way.
Yes.
But anyway... But apparently there is an angle which was not shown on the television, which has come out subsequently. And it appears maybe the same thing has happened, because the morning after the France-Uruguay game, a photograph was posted by World Rugby along with a statement for the reason why it was not mitigated down. Because I think they probably saw, oh, this looks very Owen Farrell, but treating it very, very differently.
Yeah.
And so they found a photograph which, or it may have been from a TV angle, I don't know. But the point being is there is obviously other evidence which is available, which is not being used, which brings me to the point where I think there are people on the broadcasting of some of these games who don't know the sport of rugby, because the ability in the time we have to get good replays of the bits that you would want, it doesn't seem to be happening in a lot of cases. And I wonder if that is, and that is just further exacerbating the point you're making, Phil, which is you've got lesser qualified people with inadequate evidence making decisions.
We've already done 20 minutes on this, so I must hurry you up.
I completely agree with that, and I think if World Rugby actually want to do something positive, every time there is an appeal process or a judicial panel held, they should release the additional footage. Like on the panel that changed the Owen Farrell decision first time around, before it got appealed by World Rugby themselves, they saw footage that we did not see Just make that footage available. Like, allow us to see what other people are seeing. Don't just hide it behind this curtain, because it feels like something dodgy is going on, even if perhaps it's not.
Mm. Yeah.
Anyway, I've
got to get some stuff sent over to TalkSport. I'm on the radio in about 6 hours, and I've got to go and grab the bus in about half an hour to get myself back into town. So. I'm going to have to go and do a little bit of work, and if you're still going, I'll jump back on once I've got the thing sent over, if that's all right.
You go for it, mate.
I think we're going to wrap up, because I'm going to head home.
Okay, cool.
Just about now.
Okay,
cool. Awesome. Well, hopefully you talked about, if you haven't already, you're going to talk about how fun Fiji are.
Yeah, so we're going to do Fiji right now for 5 minutes.
Okay. Good.
Brilliant.
So, what happened last time? When was last time that Fiji beat Australia?
A while ago. Do you know precisely when it was?
I'm pretty sure it was 1956.
Oh, amazing.
Which is quite something.
Lovely.
This was amazing. This was... you wanted an upset. Well, we finally got one. And it tells me one thing about Australia. Two things about Australia. One, they've got horrible discipline. Two, they are very reliant on two players, and they were not available today, and this caused them all manner of problems. Will Skelton and... your big prop, whose name escapes me?
Taniela Tupu.
Both of them are not available. Both made an absolute huge difference. It also tells me that Fiji are a legit rugby team in many, many ways. Lavani Bhatia, some of his turnovers today were world class.
He's amazing. He is such a good player. And to think that he was wearing 7 today, but he could legitimately have been wearing 12 today. Yep. And played just as well, to your point before about utility players.
Yeah.
Players playing in multiple different positions.
Yeah, this team looks bloody dangerous. They were better than Australia throughout the entire game in every single aspect of the sport.
Yeah.
They're better in the scrum. They're better in the line-out. They're better defensively. They could turn over the ball. They could run it better. They were just better than Australia in every single way. That's going to be hard for Australia to listen to, but there's no other way to describe what happened today. At one point, towards the end, about 80 minutes, they got into a kicking battle, which you would expect a team like Australia to win. Fiji won it comfortably. It wasn't even close. They made very good decisions throughout the entire game. And then, of course, they can back it up with the fact that they have mutants playing for them. Like Joshua Tuosova.
Or Naya Salevu.
Oh, my word.
Or Lavani Bhatia.
Yep,
or
indeed.
Or Albert Tuosubi. Or Velama Mata. Or Semi Radrandra.
Yes, who did very Semi Radrandra things today. He dropped the ball, he knocked it on a few times, but he did carry hard.
He carries hard and he beats defenders.
Yeah, he does. He does those things. Now, can everyone just admit I was right on this fella? I am right on this fella, aren't I? Just admit it.
It depends what point you're making, because you make two distinct points at different times.
He's not very good at rugby. Well, he's not very good at rugby. No. He's not as good at rugby as people say. He's not worth the money. He's vastly overvalued.
So that point, the is he worth £1 million a year or whatever Bristol was paying for him?
No.
No. And no, almost no one is worth £1 million a year.
Charles Pietau is.
Maybe Charles Pietau, maybe Taniela Tupu, maybe
Skelton probably is.
Maybe Will Skelton is one of the few players. Maybe the South African tight end, whose name escapes me right now.
Yeah, I mean, look, your number eight, who plays on the wing and wing and centre, is not worth £1 million. He'd be a great number eight for someone, like legitimately.
He's enormous.
Yeah,
he's very strong. He beats defenders. But he only runs in one dimension. He only runs straight at and over people.
Why? Like, people got so carried away with him. He's going to light up the Premiership. He's going to be the best thing ever to play in the Premiership. It's going to be amazing. He was good. Sometimes. At certain things. Look, if you want a guy to carry, that's it. If you want volume, he would actually be really good with volumes of carries from the back row. But if you want him to have one intervention... a critical intervention to finish a try, this is categorically not the right man to be on the wing.
So I've got the history of Australia and Fiji rugby in front of me now.
Yes.
They first played in 1952 on the Sydney Cricket Ground. Australia won. And then Fiji won two out of the next three. So come June 1954, Fiji have won 50% of the encounters, two out of four. Following June 1954, again at the Sydney Cricket Ground, Australia won every single encounter apart from one draw until the 23rd encounter, 17th of September 2023, this time around, when Fiji won.
Amazing stuff.
So you have to go back to 1954 for the last time that Fiji beat Australia in rugby.
If Australia see Fiji again, maybe the final or something, if they're both lucky enough to qualify.
Maybe. Who knows?
Their best chance of beating Fiji is to lobby for a cut in their funding. That is the only way to beat Fiji for Australia.
Oh, love seeing Fiji win. And this blows that. So I thought that Australia were going to walk this group.
Yeah.
I thought once Wales beat Fiji, I thought Australia were going to win, Wales were going to come second.
I don't think
Wales has blown it wide open. Yeah.
I don't think Wales are happy with this result.
Wales, I'm not sure Wales are qualifying now, because I'm not sure Wales can beat Fiji.
No, they have to beat Fiji.
I'm not sure Wales can beat Australia.
Yeah.
I'm not even sure Wales can beat Georgia.
Yeah.
The only team I'm confident in Wales beating is Portugal.
But I'm not sure Fiji will beat Georgia.
I'm not sure Fiji will beat Georgia. Georgia are a hell of a team.
Actually, Portugal could beat Georgia, I think.
I think Wales made Portugal look good. Although I did, my favourite moment of all the rugby I've watched in the last few days, which has been a lot, was that Portugal try.
Yeah.
That Portugal try, the little sneaky line-out move, was a thing of beauty.
I'm just trying to think of anything good for Australia, and there is one thing good for Australia. That is Rob Volantini, who really put his hand up.
Bobby V is an absolute baller.
And he was defending most of the time. He was hitting everything that moved. I like him. And that is all I can say positive about Australia. Is there anything you want to like say?
Nawangui Tanasi, if I've said that right, which I probably haven't. He's a lovely player when he gets ball in hand. Other than that, not really.
Jordan Pitai can kick it very far.
Yeah, they've got some great players, but they're not a great team.
No, they're very shallow, aren't they? They're very shallow.
I think even though England lost to Fiji less than 3 weeks ago, or maybe 3 weeks ago, I think England will fancy their chances playing their simplistic game plan against whoever emerges, hopefully second in this group, which could be Australia, could be Fiji, could be Wales, could be Georgia. Yeah. Could even be Portugal. Who knows? That's the miracle of this World Cup.
This is the miracle is the group of death is not the group of death that we expected.
It's the group of I don't know, whichever team is slightly weaker to make it out of the mud of this group, or Oof. Slightly stronger.
Well, I loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I was cheering Fiji all the way, and they might be my third favourite team between South Africa and France now.
You go for the big guns first.
Oh, yeah, I love how they play. And I'm looking forward to South Africa absolutely battering Ireland next week.
Fiji might be my third favourite team as well. England first, Ireland second.
So dull and predictable.
That Ireland team, so they did make mincemeat of a very handy Tonga team. It wasn't even close.
There was it?
They absolutely battered. And I loved some of their... It's like we talk... Like England, they have no ambition to do anything fancy, but they also can't do anything fancy. Ireland team, some of the lovely little... Like the basic wraparounds and the balls back inside. The balls back inside for that... Like the Tyburn... Caelan Doris back inside for that Tyburn try. I think it was the first try of the game after 20 minutes. Things like they're just some beautiful lines executed perfectly by powerful men running onto the ball at pace.
Stop it, you're exciting me.
It's lovely. It is. Great to see.
Right, well, we might reconvene tomorrow. I'm sure Tim has other things to say to us, which are vitally important, of course.
always.
Always. So until then, you can follow us, wherever just email us. I'm not going to reply to anything on Facebook. I haven't done for months. I'm not on the Twitter.
I don't even have access to the Twitter anymore.
Yeah, so
I do have access to the Gmail, and we get some some really
belting emails,
some real contact egg chasers at Gmail. We get some. We might not always read them out, but
I have sent voice notes back to people that have emailed me just to explain things in a bit more detail because I love the emails. The emails are where it's at. So if you want to email us, email us.
Yeah.
Other than that, I don't care. Don't do
it. Some of our emails are absolutely superb, and they do, even if we don't explicitly mention you, they do come across our thinking.
Yep.
Like, they are superb. So thank you very much for all our engaged and interested participants at that.
So that is eggchasers at... contacteggchasers@gmail.com. Anyway, that's enough of that. So, Phil, goodbye.
Goodbye, JB.
A long-distance goodbye from Tim, and goodbye from me as well. So, bye.
Even on a budget, quality is non-negotiable. That's why Quince is the place to score high-end essentials at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Get your hands on buttery soft cashmere sweaters from just $60, Italian leather jackets, and so much more. And the best part about Quince? They exclusively partner with factories committed to safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Elevate your style without the elevated price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/upgrade for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Mom deserves the best, and there's no better place to shop for Mother's Day than Whole Foods Market. They're your destination for unbeatable savings, from premium gifts to show-stopping flowers and irresistible desserts. Start by saving 33% with Prime on all body care and candles. Then get a 15-stem bunch of tulips for just $9.99 each with Prime. Round out Mom's menu with festive rosé, irresistible berry chantilly cake, and more special treats. Come celebrate Mother's Day at Whole Foods Market.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.